KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I'm pleased to be sitting across from a man who I think has changed narrative films in the past few years, from his films Play and Involuntary, one of my favorites, A Force Majeure, and his newest film, of course, is The Square. I'm talking to the director, Ruben Östlund. Ruben, first of all, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I love that you have so much fun with the idea of narrative. You don't like the idea of, like, an extended plot, do you?
No. I mean, I think that brought up during a period when internet came.
Actually,
I'm older than internet. It's true.
Okay.
It's happened something with the whole area that we are working in, if you're working with as a feature film director, I think. Because I think that the most interesting moving images that I have seen the last 15 years actually have been on internet and have been on YouTube. And I think if we look at the kind of expression that you can use to when you're using moving images, you can really, you know, highlight human behavior in a very specific way. And if you step away a little bit from the storytelling and the plot and you just focus on a single situation, sometimes it can point out so much about what it is to be a human being. And I can tell you about a YouTube clip that I love that I have been recommending before, but I think that everybody should try to look it up. It's called Taxi Driver on the BBC. And you have seen it, right?
Yeah.
It's a taxi driver that by accident ends up in a live broadcast news program on BBC, and the journalist thinks he's an expert on internet rights. And in the moment when the journalist is introducing him for the TV audience, and she's like, says, "Welcome to Guy Cuny," the taxi driver realizes this horrible mistake. And the face expression when he's trying to avoid losing face is just fantastic. And then he's like looking with fear towards the journalist, and then with fear into the camera towards the audience that is sitting there in front of the TV screens. And then instead of saying, "This is a horrible mistake," he says, "Good morning." And he starts to play this internet expert. He's starting to adapt to the expectations of who he should be. And for me, that YouTube clip is really pointing out that moving images can tell us so much about how we are trying to live up to expectations. That we are so scared of losing our face. So we actually are, sometimes we do things that is so much more connected to the expectations that than like saying, "Sorry, this is a horrible mistake." And for me, these kind of movements, I have not really seen them before in film history. But now, when we are almost shooting every single moment that we experience and that we can put it up also and distribute it in that way, suddenly we have access to an image bank of moving images where we really, really can explore human behavior. And when I'm making a feature film, of course, I also know that I'm dealing with a show. I'm dealing with a length of 2 hours or so or something. So the film have to make sense and it have to like catch the audience's attention. But I want to build my movies out of that every single scene should have a quality that at least is getting close to a little bit reaching for that quality that you can see in the best YouTube clips.
I think there are a few scenes like that in The Square, the scene where Dominic West is talking about Robert Smithson, and then there's suddenly that outburst in the audience. That could be a YouTube clip almost, couldn't it?
Definitely. I mean, that is something that actually happened to me. I was on a theater play. I have a friend that is a theater director. And on his premiere of this play, then suddenly there's like someone in the audience that goes like, "Psh." And everybody was like, "What was that?" You know? And maybe it was like just something that happened and you don't pay that much attention to it. But after a while, he goes again like, "Rah!" everybody gets terrified, you know, like he's doing something that's completely forbidden. There's an actor on the stage that is trying to perform, and at the same time, this guy is disturbing him. And then we realize he has Tourette's syndrome. And it's probably one of the most interesting theater plays I've been to. Because there was like a struggle for the actors to like grab the attention from the audience. But the most interesting thing was this guy that was sitting in the audience and had his problems with Tourette's. But what was beautiful with that moment was that the theater in Stockholm where I was watching the play, they actually knew about this guy. And they know about that he has this handicap. But still, they think he should be allowed to go to theater. So they actually have given him some cotton gloves, you know, so it shouldn't sound that loud when he's clapping. And it's a beautiful, how do you say, image of tolerance, I think.
Well, so much of your work is about tolerance. I mean, there is that great scene in the 7-Eleven where the little boy is screaming about what's happened to him, that he's been targeted as a criminal. Because we'll talk a little bit more about the square in the moment. And the assistant is trying to respond to him. Everybody's trying to get him to stay quiet, but he won't stay quiet because he's a little kid and he doesn't know any better. And he's not interested in being polite in a classic Swedish kind of way.
He has nothing to lose in some ways. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that happens a lot, though. There is often a character in your pieces who has nothing to lose.
Yeah. But, you know, I think that I'm interested in setups where the social contract is broken in some way. You know, I think that, is it something that we are sensitive to as human beings, is that there's an unoutspoken social contract in every situation, basically. And when someone is breaking that social contract, what are the new rules? How should I react? How should I correspond? And I think in those moments, it says so much about ourselves and our behavior and how we are trying to deal with these moments. And this little boy that I was fond of the idea, you know, if you're an adult man and suddenly it comes a little boy accusing you for doing the wrong thing, it's scary, isn't it? So, yeah.
I think that happens a few times in the movie. And I, every time, and you set the square in the art world where there are these social contracts about what behavior is and what art is supposed to be. And once somebody violates that contract, nobody knows how to respond. I mean, there's an interview at the very beginning of the movie where there's this ridiculous statement about publicness.
Yeah, yeah. I can tell you about that text that actually it's Elizabeth Moss' character that is having an interview with Klaus Bang that plays Christian, the chief curator in the museum. And I mean, she's taking an excerpt from something she found on the webpage of the museum, and it's like a exhibition, non-exhibition, an evening conversation about the exhibitable and the practice of publicness in the spirit of Robert Smithson's sight, non-sight. You know, it's just blub, 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 blub. And the thing is, I have to confess something now then, because, you know, that text, I actually stole it because I'm on the University of Film Directing in Gothenburg in Sweden. And I stole that text from a professor that is on the fine art departments of the same school. And I didn't ask for permission. You know, when you're making a movie, it's a lot of decisions that should be made. Sometimes you forget about something. So I forgot to ask for permission. And it was kind of funny because now, just before the fall semester ended, then I had like an on-stage talk with this professor. And he had just been and watched the film, and we were supposed to talk about, yeah, a little bit, have a, how to say, interesting conversation about conflicts between the art world and the movie world, you know. And then I had to, okay, so what did you say about that your text was in the film? It's like, it was not me. He was like, really? It's like, it was not me. It was me. I didn't write that text. And because I felt so guilty because I stole it. And then, no, it was the other professor on the school, you know. It was, yeah.
My guest who's reenacting some of the violation we see in his new film, The Square, is Ruben Aslan. But that thing that in your movies that could be, if it goes 1 degree to the left, it could be tragedy, and 1 degree to the right could be comedy, happens so often. I mean, there's a whole conversation about the piles of garbage display that's accidentally been...
Excuse me, piles of gravel.
It's piles of gravel. forgive my imprecision. Yes, yes. It's a G word. I'm sorry. English is a new language to me, and I apologize. But those... And I work at a museum, so mm-hmm. I know that you're basically trying to define art for people who come in. And once they ask questions, you can go into this whole rabbit hole about what art is and is not. Mm. And the idea of having to reconstruct something that's been deconstructed in the first place is maybe... I laughed so hard at that the first time I saw that scene. Great. That's so wonderful.
Great. I mean, I think I have mixed feelings to the art world. First of all, I have to say that the square in itself... The installation piece that is in the film is actually something that me and a friend of mine created. And
it's actually about a social contract,
exactly.
Strictly speaking.
And I mean, from the beginning, I didn't want to talk about it as an installation piece. I didn't want to talk about it as art. I would like to compare it with a pedestrian crossing. You know, a pedestrian crossing is kind of a beautiful thing where you have a couple of lines in the street where we have managed to create a social contract that the car drivers should be careful with the pedestrians. And I think it's a very beautiful way of looking on, how to say, good behavior, humanistic values, from that simple perspective, not making it advanced, you know. And the same thing was the idea with the square. If we make a white marked square where we decide that within this area, we are treating each other equally, we have the same responsibility, we are putting trust in each other, it's just a way of reminding ourselves that a certain kind of behavior is possible. And so when we created this, I'd rather prefer talking about it as a humanistic traffic sign than an art installation.
No, because I think that's interesting because so much of this, we can go back to involuntary, the idea of what behavior is accepted and what is not. And there's a whole system of behaviors that are associated with museums and galleries, and people will often not go to them because they don't want to be part of that. Mm. And I say this because I think of film as being a public art, an art that demands conversation, that can be consumed everywhere, on our phones, on our tablets. I mean, it's an inescapable art form to me. And I feel that's what you're trying to do, is to say that art is this thing that shouldn't just be consigned. I mean, once you call it art, it becomes this thing that people can detach from. But in fact, art is something that belongs to everybody, isn't it?
Yeah, sure, definitely. And I think it's super important also that, of course, there are different, expressions, that the spectrum is wide, that you can, of course, deal with very advanced things and deal with an advanced theory discussion. But what I think is important is that we are being careful so we don't use that language in a way of, protecting our own position. So you use the language as a power language to exclude other people in order to maintain your own position in a hierarchy. And that is something that have happened a little bit when I look at least the art schools in Sweden, that the theory level becomes, it becomes in a way that the students feel that they can't express themselves in an intuitive way, because first of all, you need to learn the theory. And when you have the theory, then you can start to express yourself. And it's something that is a little bit, backward with that mentality, I think.
I mean, what you're talking about is really the origins of punk. The response to that, isn't it?
Yeah, sure.
And or even the idea, because I understand you're a fan of Larry David, and what he does is basically make us ask questions about behavior too, doesn't he?
I mean, I think that it's funny that you bring him up. There have been a couple of journalists that have been comparing the kind of situation comedy that is in the film with Curb Your Enthusiasm, and I actually met him last time I was in LA, and it was so fun. We was having a dinner. And there was a lot of his stand-up colleagues that were sitting around that table. And I could tell that their process of trying out their material for their stand-up comedy shows or the TV shows is very similar to what I like to do also. You know, that I'm trying out the situation by telling it to someone and see how they respond. And maybe they tell me another situation that is even more interesting. And then I just steal it and use it in the script. So, but I love that way of working, you know, that you constantly are in a dialogue. You're constantly trying out your material. And I think that Larry David also have a very sociological approach to his content. He's looking at human being in different kind of setups, in different situations, in different dilemmas, when it's easy to relate to the situation, but all of us also understands it's hard to handle this situation. And that is the comedy. And for me, that's a very humanistic approach. You don't put guilt in the individuals. You say, oh my God, poor this guy or this woman that is in this horrible setup. I can also understand why he's doing these stupid things.
We'll take a break. We're talking about humanism with my guest, Ruben Aslan. He's the director and writer of the new film, The Square is a Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? Critics rave The Greatest Hits is a music-infused romance that hits all the right notes and the most original time travel story in years. Featuring music by Nelly Furtado, Beach House, Jamie XX, and more. Watch The Greatest Hits, now streaming on Hulu.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. We're talking about YouTube and social contracts and so many other things with the very talented director, Ruben Aslan, whose new film, of course, is The Square. I know that in Involuntary, there's also a YouTube clip that inspired that whole bus sequence, too, isn't there?
Well, oh, yeah, that was actually a bus clip called
Idiot Bus Driver.
Exactly. I don't want to say it, but Idiot Spanish Bus Driver Almost Kills Students. And it's a clip from I think it's an English school class that is like on a trip to Spain somewhere, and they have this Spanish bus driver that is going in very, how do you say, scary steep roads. And what I love about that clip is, you know, it's a metaphor for a lot of things. You have someone that is supposed to drive this bus. Should we trust in this guy or not? And you can apply that metaphor to a lot of things, I think. You know, suddenly we have this bus driver that, is he mad or is he, can we put our lives in his hand, or should we revolt? Should we gather our forces and revolt toward this guy because he's going to kill us all? And so that's why I have used collective transport in quite many of my films, because I think that those situations is like very, they are metaphorical in a very interesting way.
Well, one of the things I really like about your films too are the way that you use children in the films. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was thinking about Play, and that kind of idea that children don't have any sense of what a social contract is supposed to be, that their behavior is all impulsive. And I was thinking about that great scene with Christian and his daughters when they come into his apartment. It's one of the few times he actually takes a stand.
Yeah.
He's being so busy being conciliatory and trying to sort of like make sure everybody's okay that to see him with his kids is really interesting. And there's a thing you do with children where children kind of bring out a different kind of behavior in adults. And it's been consistent in all your films.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, of course, it's interesting with children because they are not the one to blame of the society and the culture that they are brought up in. They just have to try to handle the setup that they are put into. And then, for example, when you talk about Play, that was inspired of events that actually happened in the city where I live in Gothenburg in Sweden. It was a group of young boys that was robbing other young boys in the center of the city in a mall. And the robbers, they had one thing in common, and it was that they were black. And of course, this is a very controversial image if you have five black boys robbing three white boys. And controversial in a very interesting way, I think, because I was doing research around play, and I was doing interviews with one of these boys that were the robbers. And then he told me that he was very aware of, or they were very aware of, even though they were like 12 years old or something, how to use the stereotype, the stigmatized stereotype of the black man in order to create an unoutspoken threat. And for me, if they would have been adults, it would have been something else. Of course, then you have to look at it from a different kind of perspective. But when they are these young boys, you can only see that they are using the context that they are into and trying, you know, just using this stereotype and playing along with it. And that you can tell that the stereotype is reproducing the behavior. And so as soon as you put in kids in a movie, then it reflects the context that the kids are put into. And also it reflects the behaviors of the adults. And I mean, I think then when I became a father and I'm trying to deal with being a father, constantly I can feel my daughter's way of looking at me and who I want to be in their eyes. So it's like that you suddenly have like, I have twin daughters that are 15, and suddenly have two other pair of eyes looking at myself at the same time that, of course, that I'm dealing with myself in my own consciousness. But so, yeah, it's just interesting to reflect my adult's behavior when you have kids in present.
Well, so often in the way that you deal with kids in your movies, the kids don't really have impulse control. They sort of do what they want to do at that moment, and which is an unusual thing because I'm not aware of them as being kid actors. They seem like they're really behaving in these movies, and I wonder how you go about making that happen with them because it's evident here in certainly in the square as well.
Well, one thing is with, for example, the boy in the square that is accusing Christian, the main character, of this bad behavior. Then we did a long casting and found this little boy, a super sweet kid. You know,
was he? Because he's so angry in the movie.
Yeah, no, but it's surprising that he is completely different offset, and he's a very shy guy that is, no big expressions really. But as soon as you said action, he had this ability of being like super angry and really believable in that.
No, he's terrific in it. But as you were talking a bit ago, I was just thinking about how so much of your films, and you were just talking about the way you want your daughters to perceive you, I was thinking about it in involuntary or in play, or certainly in force majeure, the idea of how people want other people to think of them is really important to you in the way you write, isn't it?
Yes. I think that human being is a very, social animal. We are a herd animal. We are constantly aware of our position in a group and in a herd. And I think that we are super socially skilled also. You know, human beings have a lot of white around our pupil, and that makes us makes it possible for us to see, even if a person is standing quite far away, we can immediately see if they are looking at us or not. So if someone is looking at you 1 second too long, you immediately get aware of it. And I think that one of our advantages as a species is that we have this ability of being very socially skillful. We constantly know how to maneuver a group. We constantly know about the hierarchy. And that makes us very efficient when it comes to working together. And so as soon as it happens something like, you know, social awkward or someone is breaking the social contract, then that is something that I think that we can relate to very strongly.
It's a treatment. We're talking about perception with the writer and director of the film, The Square, Ruben Östlund. I think, though, it's interesting because I'm so fascinated by the way you deal with masculinity in films, because it's constantly being questioned in ways that surprise your protagonists.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think we're living in a time where it's very interesting to be a man. I think that suddenly we are looking at ourselves in a much more self-reflective way. And like a couple of years back, I mean, 15 years back then, being a man was pretty much the norm. And we were looking at other kind of behaviors without like looking at our own behavior. And now it's, we are dealing with a lot of feelings now these days when it comes to being a man. And of course, it's super interesting to investigate those feelings yourself. And when it comes to the character that is played by Elizabeth Moss and Klaus Bang's character, Christian, you know, they have like a one-night stand. But if you look at the culture that we live in, it's a certain kind of, how do you say, economical transaction when a man and a woman have sex. She's giving her sexuality to the man, and then this man owes her something back. And I mean, this is of course because we are living in a patriarchy. We are living in a society where sexuality have become connected with economics. And therefore, there's like can be very complicated when we are trying to relate to this situation, when we are trying to behave towards each other without hurting each other and without, which kind of contract have we signed? And Christian is saying, we have not signed any contract. We were two adults that was going there together without any contract at all. And she's like, well, wait a little bit. Is this something you do often? And so there's so much shame connected to this that I think is super interesting.
I think so too, because you've talked in the past. I've read about behavior, and I think of you as being somebody who charts behavior throughout the course of a film, and that becomes kind of a, I would say, kind of an emotional narrative rather than strictly speaking a plot, and how those behaviors sort of crash up against each other from scene to scene. That's what really I find so attractive about the movies. That's what moves me forward, because you're not trying to say, well, this is the beginning and this is the middle and this is the end, because there are so many climaxes that if we looked at it in that way, then we'd be exhausted halfway into the film.
That's why you need to have music in between, so the audience can relax a little bit.
But this idea of, I mean, is this the way you start at the beginning, just thinking that you always wanted these films to be about behaviors rather than just dealing with the artificial construct of narrative?
I mean, I think that the drama in itself, or even if you look at the ancient Greek drama, they are, of course, very interesting, and they are used in a very interesting way in order to tell us something about ourselves.
They're meant to make us ask questions about ourselves.
Yeah, but what I also, as I told you before, I felt that, you know, I started as a ski filmmaker. I was making ski films. I was filming free skiing in the Alps and also in North America, in Alaska and Canada. And then when you're filming skiing, it's not about the narrative at all. It's only about trying to capture that moment.
And the achievement.
Yeah, exactly.
And whether it's success or failure.
Exactly. When everything, you know, when one of these skiers are doing like this flip in a perfect way and lands it and pulls everything off and you capture it with the camera. So I come from a background where filming was about something else than storytelling. And also what I told you before, when it came to this digital era and the paradigm change that have happened when it comes to our industry, I think there's something about the expression that I've developed in a way that I feel really, really attracted to. And I think that one challenge for us as a film director today is that we have to compare ourselves to the strongest images that we see on YouTube.
Every day, all the time.
Yeah, all the time. And if I succeed to make a film that I think is good, of course, there's like a lot of scenes that together should work as a movie in itself. And you should grab the audience's attention, because I think they are quite linearly told, the films. But I want every single brick that is used in that movie to be able to stand by itself. I think that I at least have that as an approach and a goal when I'm writing and when I'm shooting the scenes.
I'm sorry, we're out of time. I could talk to you about this all day. Ruben, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
My guest is Ruben Oslin, the man who makes us ask questions about our behavior all the time. His newest movie doing that is The Square. Our recording engineer here at NPR West is Patrick Murray. The show is mixed by Kat Yor. It's edited by Blake Veit, who's associate producer. I don't know how to behave. It's the treatment.
catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.